Looking forward to working with you.
Good morning. Welcome to the first meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. I'm excited to see you all here and especially impressed that we're starting very close to exactly on time on our first day. I hope we can make that a regular occurrence. We've got a busy agenda today, the standard adoption of committee rules. I hope we can all take a minute or two to introduce ourselves and some of the things we want to accomplish. We've got some committee measures to introduce, and then we're going to start with an overview of higher education. I'll have some more to say about that in a minute. But let's start with the organizational meeting and a work session on the adoption of committee rules. So the committee rules are before you. They are the standard rules that you will see repeatedly over the next day or two. And with that, unless there's any specific discussion about that, I'd be interested in a motion. Representative Gallegos?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos has moved the adoption of the committee rules as presented. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnik.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, were these looked at by the bipartisan group, I think, is that correct, the committee rules and the House rules?
Yes, they were.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. The rules are adopted. And we'll close the work session on the adoption of committee rules. And I'd like to take just a moment to let people introduce themselves to the committee, perhaps something about where you're from, what brings you to the committee, and maybe what you're interested in accomplishing in the committee. Fair warning, I'm not excusing our capable committee administrator and committee assistant from this either. Shall we start Representative Hayden, and we can move this direction? Is that okay?
Sure.
Great. Sir?
So I'm Representative Hayden. I'm from House District 7, which is down Cottage Grove to Roseburg area. I'm pleased to be a member of the higher education, interested in working in that area, particularly in the innovation and workforce development. I'd like to have the opportunity to work on some kind of trade school agendas, both at our higher education level and our high school level.
Thank you.
And I'm Jeff Reardon, state rep for District 48, which is outer southeast Portland, down into Happy Valley. And I'm delighted to be part of this committee. I'm also on the House Ed Committee, so I'm supposed to keep track of the continuity between the work that we do in different committees. But as many of you may know, I have been a school board member. I was on David Douglas School Board for 10 years. Also taught high school for a total of 16 years. The last 10 before getting into this job was at David Douglas, so kind of unusual. I've been working really hard on the last couple of years on career technical education in particular, and trying to look at their own programs as they go, say, roughly from grade 7 through 14, and hopefully those kids that want to can go beyond grade 14. But that's the area that I care a lot about. I was a shop teacher. And so that's, I think there's a lot we can do on that, and eager to work with you on advancing education of all forms.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Caddy McEwen. I represent House District 9, which is down on the south coast. Coos Bay, north to Yahats, is the main part of my district. As Representative Reardon experienced, I was a school board member in Coos Bay for 11 years. I also spent 8 years working for the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, supervising a mentoring program that dealt with bringing volunteers into high schools to help students navigate the very complex waters of how you find whatever education or training it is going to meet your goals after high school, how you be a good consumer in using the resources that you have available to pay for it, and helping kids through that very complex scholarship and financial aid application process. So I'm very interested in the cost of higher ed and how we help students come out of whether it's community college or any kind of a training program or a four-year school with the least amount of debt possible. Concerns me greatly. I also co-chaired the apprenticeship task force in the last session, and we're working very hard to provide more access for our young people to training that is not necessarily the four-year college route or the two-year college route, but those skills that we need to develop to bolster our workforce as we have an exit of the folks that are our age. We're losing a very skilled workforce that we need to begin to replace, and hopefully as the economy continues to become more robust, that we are able to fill those jobs that we're going to create over the next few years as we begin to invest in infrastructure and things of the like that are going to help us along in a lot of aspects of making the state successful.
Thank you. Representative Wisnett.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. I look forward to working with you. I think this is my fourth session working education. It used to be education included higher education. Served, I think, one session under Peter Buckley as vice chair. Last session, I served with members of this committee on higher ed. We did a lot of work last session. I represent House District 53. When I started, House District 53 was mostly all of Deschutes County. Now I've lost most of Deschutes County because of population growth in the Bend area. And so I now represent the city of Bend, Tumbalo in that area, and about one-third or a little less of the population of Bend, and my home, Sun River, a part of South Deschutes County. As a conversation, we're in transition still in Central Oregon in jobs, so we're really interested in workforce development and innovation. My goals in this committee are to make higher ed more affordable, which means decreasing cost and increasing access. I've learned a lot. I served a couple of years on the as a commissioner on the Education Commission of the states, and heard from other states a lot of good ideas that they were doing. So look forward to serving with Mr. Chair.
Good. Thank you. I'm Tobias Reed. I'm from Beaverton. This is my fifth term, and to the extent I've been able to craft sort of a legislative major, it's around economic growth. And so I'm especially excited about this committee that takes in so many of the things that I think are critical to economic growth. And I'm particularly interested, after we get through the kind of introductions to these three kind of pillars of our committee, to the ways that they connect. And I think that's going to be a good part of our discussion. So I'm looking forward to working with all of you as well. Ms. Cox.
My name is Victoria Cox. I'm the committee administrator, and I've been here since 2009. I live in Representative Nearman's district, just south of Willamette Valley Vineyards. And I'm interested in whatever you all want to discuss.
Thank
very
you.
Astute.
Joe Gallegos. I'm a representative for House District 30, which is Hillsborough and North Plains, some of Alloa, a couple of houses in Beaverton. That district also has the high-tech industries, and so people claim it's the economic engine of the state, so we want to pay particular attention to workforce development. I'm on this committee, I think, for a number of reasons. One, because I asked for it, but also because my background, I think, is well-suited for this. I'm Professor Emeritus at University of Portland. I've been on faculties of fairly large institutions, University of Washington, San Diego State University, and also University of Portland, which is a pretty small private school. As an academic, I've been a professor and administrator. I've accredited a number of programs throughout the years, and so you know, I think as I said, can serve this committee well in terms of dealing with higher education. I do want to thank previous members of this committee for the hard work that they did in the past few sessions, really bringing that whole institutional system within Oregon to the reorganization and the development of the HEC. I think that was a major, major achievement of prior legislators. I think now, though, I mean, we still have some nuts and bolts to deal with in terms of the application and implementation of that program, but I think we're ready now to take what I see as sort of the important next step in terms of making the transition and really looking at the lens of workforce development and how do we make then the link between higher ed and workforce development, and recognizing higher ed does not just mean four-year institutions or master's or PhD traditional programs, but also trade schools and community colleges and so on. Just what are all the ways that we can think about increasing opportunities to meet the need for the state of Oregon's workforce in the near future? I should mention I'm also a gerontologist, so I really am very concerned about the baby boomers and the retiring generation, that folks can't really afford to retire. So we need to think about them in terms of workforce. What's their place in the new workforce? How are we going to incorporate and include those folks as they continue to be an asset to the state? So I think those are the things I'd say right now.
Great. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark Johnson from House District 52. I live in Hood River, where, as we like to say, it's all good in the hood. By the way, I'm sorry to hear that Rep. Wisnett lost all the brew pubs in his former district, so that's too bad. Happy to be here. This is my third term on this committee, originally appointed back in 2011 when I actually co-chaired the committee, so it was during some real formative time. We dealt with some really significant governance issues and did some good work. Continue to serve at the local level. I'm in my 10th year of service on the Hood River County School Board, which I think is a great place to be able to see how policies we pass here actually, are they workable? Do they have a good outcome at the local level or not? So that's been a good thing. I've been passionate about public education. I've also served with Representative McEwen on the Apprenticeship Task Force as well, and hoping that we can really use this committee to focus on that issue, because we obviously know we have a need to fill a lot of places in our skilled workforce that is rapidly aging and so forth, and we've got to do some things to increase the size of the pipeline that's providing apprenticeships to our workforce. So glad to be here and look forward to working with all of you.
Thank you. Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everyone. I'm Jennifer Williamson. I represent House District 36, which is downtown Northwest and Southwest Portland. I first started working on higher ed issues when I was 18 years old at the University of Oregon as a member of the Oregon Student Association. So I've been working on college affordability for, you know, like 5 years or so. So for a long, long time. And so I'm excited to be on this committee to continue that work in a way that's more concrete and tangible than just as a member of our esteemed body. So thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So my name is Mike Nierman. Hi, everybody. I'm the state representative from House District 23, which the biggest city in that district is Dallas. And it's kind of a long rural district that goes north from Dayton all the way south to Monroe and a lot of the rural areas in between there. I'm really excited to be on this committee. I'm happy to hear that hear words like economic development and effectiveness and those kinds of things. So I don't have any special expertise in education. I'm on the Central School District Budget Committee, but that and 50 cents will get you a cup of coffee in Dallas there. But I've been a consumer of higher education and a payer both for myself and for my kids. So the affordability of schools is important. So I have a lot to learn, and I hopefully have a lot to offer too. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Larmer.
I'm Zachary Larmer, and I'm the committee secretary.
You got to say a little more than that. How did you get here? What's your background?
I graduated from the University of Montana.
Grizzlies.
Job, so I'm excited to be here.
Very good. Thank you. Well, I'm pleased there's such a diversity of experience and expertise, interest on the committee. I think we're going to have some fun and hopefully do some good work. Thanks for the introductions. With that, I want to open a work session on the introduction of committee measures, and I'll explain just a moment why there are so many. Having been a chair before, I've noticed that there is sometimes some utility later on in session to having some vehicles to use for things we don't yet anticipate. So with one exception, that's what all of these are. They're relating to higher education, relating to innovation, relating to workforce development. We may never use them, but we'll have them in case. The one exception to that is substantive, and I have learned originally from Representative Shetterly and then from Representative Barnhart to take a very ecumenical view of the introduction of committee measures, which is to say I'm happy to introduce anything that has anything to do with our work. Who knows what happens to it after that, but it does not obligate anyone to support the bill. We don't know what they may turn into, but I'm hopeful that we can continue that tradition of supporting the introduction of committee measures. With that, Representative Gallegos.
Chair Reed, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. And so I can read through the list, the long list here. But takes up the whole page. LC 2978, dated January 7th, 2015. LC 3199, dated January 20th, 2015. LC 3200, dated January 22nd, 2015. LC 3201, dated January 22nd, 2015. LC 3202, dated January 22nd, 2015. LC 3203, dated January 22nd, 2015. LC 3204, dated January 21st, 2015. LC 3205, dated January 21st, 2015. LC 3206, dated January 21st, 2015. LC 3207, dated January 21st, 2015. LC 3208, dated January 21st, 2015. LC 3209, dated January 15, 2015. LC 3210, dated January 15, 2015. LC 3211, dated January 15, 2015. LC 3212, dated January 15, 2015. LC 3213, dated January 15, 2015.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos has moved that 15 LCs have be introduced as committee of bills. I will not read the list again. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. That list will be introduced as committee bills. Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on the introduction of committee bills and open an informational meeting on an overview of higher education in Oregon. We have Ben Cannon, the Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Please come forward. We also have Jim Middleton, the Interim Commissioner of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, on the phone. And we will hopefully be joined soon by Bridget Burns, unless I'm not seeing her in the audience. I think she must be on her way. So I assume, Mr. Cannon, you've worked out a sequence here. I assume you're kicking us off. You get to introduce us and be our leadoff speaker. So please enlighten us.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ben Cannon. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Delighted at the continuation of a higher education committee into this session, and look forward to working with members both new to the committee and carrying on. Look forward to a very productive session. Appreciate the opportunity that the chair has provided today for me and Jim and Bridget to follow to make some introductory remarks and have, I hope, a bit of a conversation about higher education in Oregon. What I intend to do over the next little bit with the help of some slides is to really provide some background, much of which will be familiar to many of you, but perhaps some new perspectives, some new data. I'll talk about our state goals for higher education with a particular focus on 2020. I'll talk a bit about the students, the institutions, the structure for higher education, particularly in the wake of some recent and significant changes that result in part with the creation of the HEC, as well as institutional boards for universities. I'll talk a little about state financing and budgeting for higher education. I'll preview some of what we see as some upcoming likely issues that you'll be facing this session. And then I'll conclude and turn it over to Jim with some thoughts about a potential path forward and some real opportunities for meeting our goals or coming closer to them. I want to note I have my Oregon Ducks pen here. However, I feel obligated to say at the HEC we do not play favorites. So next time I will be sure to bring a Beavers or an Owls or some other a pen. So don't take this as a sign of any favoritism on the part of Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Let me see if I can get this to operate. And at the pleasure of the chair, I'm happy to be stopped at any point with questions.
Thank you.
make it through the whole thing. So this, I expect, will be familiar to all of you. It is our state's official goal for higher education and K-12 achievement. It states that by the year 2025, 40% of adult Oregonians will hold a bachelor's or advanced degree, 40% will hold an associate's degree or meaningful post-secondary certificate, and all adult Oregonians will hold a high school diploma. And several of you were instrumental in adopting, putting this goal into statute back in 2011. We can express that with a simple graph or simple chart, if you will, and we can also talk about how we're doing against it. And this data from 2013 uses survey results, essentially, to attempt to ascertain the progress of Oregon towards that 40-40-20 goal. You'll note, of course, the significant gaps. Less significant, interestingly, at the bachelor's and advanced degree level, where we benefit, among other things, from the immigration of relatively well-educated people compared to our outflow, but quite significant at that associate's degree or certificate level. And, of course, too many students who aren't completing high school or are completing at some point but not earning a post-secondary credential or degree. I'll highlight with the third chart here as sort of an equity lens that looks at that the progress of selective racial or ethnic subgroups, and specifically African American, Hispanic, and Native American groups, that show as far as we have to go for Oregonians generally, we have an even greater distance to go for some of our populations who have been most underrepresented in higher education historically. Couple of minutes on definitions. So 40-40-20, if you look back to the original, back to the definition, is actually quite clear that it describes a goal for all adult Oregonians. And the state, and certainly the HEC, has sort of wrestled with that idea that 40% of all adult Oregonians would have earned a bachelor's degree, 40% associates or certificate, and actually 100% have completed high school, all adult Oregonians, by the year 2025. So we've attempted, and your chair participated in some conversations with the Oregon Education Investment Board in early 2014 that resulted in a sort of policy statement by that board, as well as by the HEC, that begins to try to distinguish between the goal of 40-40-20 for all adults and the goal of 40-40-20 for our pipeline of incoming students, for younger students rising in the system. And how we've tried to think about this is that 40-40-20 does express very clearly our goals for that high school class of 2025, today's second graders. I know because I have one. Today's second graders, we do expect and intend that 40-40-20 applies to them in those percentages. And likewise, the statute's quite clear that it also applies to the entire adult population. But our recommendation and our sort of interpretation is that that latter adult population goal should be continually refined based on actual labor market needs and valuable certificates, and may not be for higher education precisely 40-40. Perhaps our goals for educational attainment for adults in their 50s or 60s is refined to reflect actual labor, what we can discern about actual labor market needs, job openings, and that our investments and policy approaches to the adult population ought to be clearly adjusted to reflect what is meaningful for that population and what is likely to lead to a job. The other significant definitional issue that 40-40-20 raises is about the middle 40. The reality is the statute, I think very appropriately, is open-ended about what is included within that middle 40, associate's degree or certificate-related credential. And the Oregon Education Investment Board and the HEC have endorsed a broad understanding of what counts for the middle 40. This legislature in 2014 very clearly added in statute that apprenticeship, registered apprenticeships count. We would suggest that career pathway certificates and other industry-based nationally recognized certificates, state licensure, should count as well. But essentially, we take a broad understanding of what is included in the middle 40. This is not all about degrees, not all about even associate's degrees, but a variety of other certificates and other endorsements, many of them attained through institutions of higher education, but again, not necessarily degree-granting ones, that can support the development of this robust, skilled workforce around middle 40 credentials.
Interrupt for just a second with a question, Representative Wisnik.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Cannon, I think we started a program for those people that dropped out, and you can get back to me on this, on the four-year program that dropped out. Don't we have an active program where the junior or community colleges now can award an associate degree for those people who dropped out of the four-year program? I'd like to see how that's working.
Sure. Representative Wisnett, Chair Reed, I think what you were referring to is the reverse transfer program we have, where students who have begun at a community college, continued their education at a four-year institution before they received their two-year degree, so they've transferred before earning associate's degree, may be awarded an associate's degree as a virtue, as a result of having completed the necessary courses at the four-year level. And it involves essentially conversation between work between registrars at the public university or the four-year university and the community college.
Yes, please.
Be happy to provide data.
Yeah, let's talk separately. But I think there's a program that just to try to reach goals and have people with a certificates or degree or whatever, that four-year schools, they may have not started a community college, but they started a four-year, dropped out. But they can go back and look and see if a community college based upon their courses could award it. So we'll talk about it.
Yeah, be happy
Thank
to.
Thank you.
Thanks. I'd just note before moving past this middle 40 slide that one of the challenges that a broad understanding that we endorse creates is around data. It's a pretty simple matter to know how many certificates and degrees the state's community colleges are awarding annually. That is clearly, that's data that we maintain. Once you start to broaden, as I think it is appropriate, clear, we've established it's appropriate to do to a variety of other certificates and credentials, it's a much sort of squishier question of about how many Oregonians are earning these. So we fall back on survey data, and I showed that data at the outset. I will note that the American Community Survey essentially census data that we rely on at this point to measure our progress towards 40-40-20 does not ask Oregonians how many of them are in the middle 40. Right? It does not ask how many have or whether an Oregonian, it does not ask Oregonians whether they have earned a certificate or degree that counts towards the middle 40. It asks questions about whether you have attended college, whether you've earned an associate's degree, whether you've earned a bachelor's degree, but we've had to really try to piece that data together to get a sense of where we are in the middle 40. And as a result, it's rough, and it's likely to continue to be, especially as long as we include a definition that's as broad as this one.
So what do you have planned as far as trying to address the roughness of that data?
Well, for the state's part, for the HECS part, in addition to improving and ensuring the accuracy of the data that we get from our public colleges and universities, we are collecting more information about completions from our private colleges, universities, and trade schools in order to more clearly understand their contribution to the middle and upper 40. You'll see sort of in an upcoming slide that the variety of institutions with which the HEC interfaces, some of those, namely the public side, we get very detailed student records and completion data from. Others we get very little from. Part of the way that we can more accurately track Oregon's progress is to get better data from those institutions. We are working on that.
Sure. Question to that same kind of issue with regard to data. I'm particularly interested in the fact that we have like three different entities that are doing CTE kind of training. So we've got high schools that have very sophisticated programs. We have community colleges, and then we have unions that have their trade programs. So again, getting data across those realms is difficult. But you made me think too about there's also then the for-profit institutions as well. And do they report in the same way the rest of our state schools do, or not?
Representative Gallegos, Chair Reed, no, they do not report in the same way. However, they do have a relationship with the HEC and a reporting one, and we have the opportunity to get better data from those institutions, and we are in the process of doing so, and I'd be happy to sort of update you on where that work stands specifically.
Thank you.
This is national data, and I would love to be able to reproduce this slide for Oregon. It comes from the Gates Foundation. We're working on an Oregon-based version. I thought it was important to, in a somewhat comprehensive way, try to express what our population of college-going students looks like. And again, this is national. I have every reason to think that Oregon's data is similar to this, although undoubtedly there would be some differences as well. I'll point out just a couple of things. So this is America as 100 college students. First of all, age. We very often operate with a mindset that higher education is all about students who are 18, 19, 20, 21 years old. Well, clearly, and you know this, we have many, many adult students, older adult students in higher education. And so the national data here, 34% over the age of 25, a full 22% over the age of 30. Employment, again, probably no surprise to members of this committee, but nationally, 72% of college students who are working, either full-time or part-time, are enrollment data. And actually, these numbers strike me as, if anything, underemphasizing the number of students who work and the number of students who are enrolled part-time. Here, nationally, according to this data, 37% are enrolled part-time. I hope that the picture that this paints is of a student population that is working, that is enrolling in school very often part-time or maybe going back and forth between full-time and part-time, and a student population that is diverse. And again, national data and Oregon's will undoubtedly look differently, but when you I certainly would draw your attention to the percentage of students here who are Black, Hispanic, Asian Pacific Islander, American Indian, Alaska Native, significant, and we know this is true of Oregon, significant increase in diversity of our higher education population.
We have another question. Representative McEwen.
Oh, thank you, Chair Reed. Mr. Cannon, a couple of questions. What is the year? What's the date on this slide? Is that current?
It is, Representative McNew and Chair Reed, it is a recent report, and I suspect that because there are a variety of data sources involved, some of them may be as old as 2012 or 2013, okay. But this report kind of came out in the last year.
This teases something out that in a former life I worked in access to education after high school, and I'm looking at the gender numbers that you see up there, and to a year over a 10-year period ending in 2010 or so, working with high school counselors, people who worked with college access in high schools, and community volunteers who were mentoring high school students in about 100 different high schools, we year after year after year ran into a roadblock. We had, and this is a good thing for women, we had two girls for every guy that was applying for college scholarships. And I see we still have a discrepancy in males to females who are attending. And we worked incredibly hard to try and move that dial and were not successful in engaging young men in this process in a meaningful way. I'm wondering if that's on your radar. Is it something that you're looking at in what's happening with the young men that are coming out of our high schools and not engaging at the rate of young women? And it's great for women, but we're leaving some young men behind. Is that something that you all are talking about?
Representative McEwen, Chair Reed, it's a great question. And I'm going to try very hard with this committee not to answer questions the way I'm about to very often. But what I am going to say is that the origins of that challenge, like many others, I think exist in K-12. And it's something that we certainly should be paying attention to at that level, as well as should be paying attention to at the higher education level, especially with respect to our access programs, our student success programs, our efforts to help more students succeed. And when we see that the gap that you've highlighted on gender, it does call for The types of strategies that would close that gap. No, our commission has not focused on that particular gap. I suspect that if you talk to institutional representatives, many of which I'm sure you will over the course of this session, it would be a good question to put to them about ways that their campuses may be attempting to address the gender gap and increasing gender gap.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, Mr. Cannon, again, I realize this. We don't know where this data, and it doesn't reflect Oregon. I hope that 75% of the figure they said for classroom-only technology versus online and things, I don't think that's correct. And representing a district's trying to build a four-year university, I don't think we're going to ever have 75% of the students only in class and not taking online or other type of credits. I find that one questionable.
Representative with the Chair Reed, I think that's undoubtedly one where there is a rapid movement and that classroom-only number certainly diminishing. I will finally point out from this slide, just again, to try to paint a picture of the diversity of our population that's attending college, that 26% have children. I mean, you sort of think about, again, that sort of typical model we operate with, 18, 19-year-old, 20, that we may hold in our head, 20-year-olds. Full 20% of America's college students have children. This data comes from WICHE. It is a look at our both recent high school graduating classes as well as projected high school graduating classes by race, ethnicity. See there, and this is Oregon-specific data, see there the very significant increases in the percentage of our high school graduates who will be Hispanic, and coupled with the lower than average college-going rates for that population, you get a sense of the challenges associated with 40-40-20 and the opportunities that we have around helping that population and other populations that have been historically underrepresented succeed in order to meet those 40-40-20 goals. This is the chart I promised that describes Oregon's higher education institutions, and I noted that the HEC touches these institutions in a variety of ways. This presentation is not focused on the HEC's responsibilities, but the third column here does call out what, in a rough kind of way, what your state agency for higher education, how we are responsible or how we intersect with our various institutions. But I think one of the things that jumps out to me from this slide is the sheer number of institutions doing business in Oregon around higher education, particularly when you look down at those bottom columns at non-Oregon degree-granting schools that are providing services to Oregon students through distance education, some of which are state-regulated, some of which are exempt, and Oregon-based private career schools that are not offering degrees but are helping to license or provide certificates to Oregon students. Obviously, your committee and our commission pays a lot of attention to the first and third rows here of public universities and our community colleges. And again, I'd be happy to go into more detail either today or at a future point in time about the HEC's responsibilities relative to each of these sectors, the question of who's regulated and who's not on the private side, those bottom rows.
Could you give us an example, perhaps, just of those? I mean, there's one across the street, for example. I suspect that may be in the state-regulated private degree granting, but what are some of the others?
And you're referring to the private degree granting schools?
I'm guessing that Willamette would be in state regulated private degree granting schools. I don't have an immediate example in my mind of what would be in the category of 62.
Right.
And below that, perhaps.
Right. Actually, so, Mr. Chair, Willamette University and its counterparts, many of which are represented by our independent colleges association, are exempt from state regulation. Okay. So they receive, in a sense, a letter from the state that notes that they satisfy the statutory requirements for being exempt from state oversight, and that has to do with their accreditation status and their history of doing business in Oregon.
Okay.
State-regulated private degree granting institutions are more likely to be for-profit, although that's not the the test. They are less likely to be accredited and less likely to have significant history, but they are in a variety of fields, a variety of parts of the state offering degrees. Non-degree granting schools in the final column, the bottom row, are career schools. So these may be in cosmetology. They may be in we visited with a school in the Medford Ashland area that trains bicycle mechanics and builders and provides certificates. So there's a variety of schools that we license in that respect.
Thank you.
We could spend a long time on these charts, and unfortunately, some of you have had to endure these previously in prior sessions. But this animated slide that I will not speak to every move you're about to see attempts to depict the changes in higher education that have occurred over the last couple of years. Just so you know what you're looking at here, the blue bars represent governing boards, if you will, and the orange boxes are institutions. And so, as you know, and this is focused on our public system, as you know, Oregon for a long time has had 17 community colleges. Those are the ones, each with their locally elected governing boards displayed there, and it has had seven public universities that until recently were governed by a single state board, the State Board of Higher Education. That has changed, not the community college side, but the university side. When we entered the 2013 session, we had essentially four state boards, in addition to the State Board of Higher Education, that had some responsibility for this system. The Oregon Education Investment Board, the HEC, which actually existed but wasn't staffed or funded, but was created in 2011. The Oregon Student Access Commission and the State Board of Education, all of which had a variety of responsibilities for the institutions and their local governing board. So, and the teal here represent agencies or administrative staff, if you will, that supported those boards. So if we look at what happened, we significantly streamlined the state responsibility. So there are now only two state boards with any responsibility for higher education in Oregon. The Oregon Education Investment Board, which of course has a P20 responsibility or birth to college and career, and the HEC. So whereas before we had an Oregon Student Access Commission separately dealing with questions of financial aid and student access, we had a separate State Board of Education dealing with our community college funding and rules. We had the State Board of Higher Ed that was involved in coordinating our public university system. All of those responsibilities, state responsibilities, have been focused on the HEC and the OEIB. Meanwhile, equally, if not more significant changes in our public university, for our public universities, where instead of a state board with responsibility for governance and coordination for all seven public universities, we created independent governing boards, state appointed, but institutionally centered for U of O, PSU, and OSU. And then in 2014, went ahead and created institutional boards that will take effect. They've been appointed and confirmed, but they will take on their full governance responsibilities in July of 2015 for the other four regional and technical universities. So this will be the new governance landscape as of July 1st, 2015.
No questions on that, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ben, this committee's done quite a bit of work over the past two sessions regarding the creation of the HEC and governance changes and stuff. And part of there was a key word in that legislation that led to the creation of the HEC, and that was consolidation. And implied in that would be the word efficiencies as well. Are we more efficient now in terms of our oversight and coordination regarding post-secondary education than we were prior to those changes we've made?
Representative Johnson, Chair Reed, I believe we are, and I think that can be demonstrated in a couple of ways. One will be through the dollars, right, and looking at state budgets and how they have changed as a result of these changes. The other will be through the efficiency of service provision and policy making. I think there was a certainly inefficiency in having one board, the State Board of Higher Ed, dealing with tuition at our public universities, while a separate state board, the Oregon Student Access Commission, was trying to deal and keep up on the financial aid side, and having a third board, the HEC or the OEIB, trying to set sort of coordination for all parts of the higher education system. The idea of having a single point of coordination, I think, creates a kind of policy-making efficiency that our commission has enjoyed. Its ability to work with the legislature and at the call of the legislature to take on issues in a really coordinated way. But be happy to follow up around some of the budget specifics. We're going to look at some of the state investment figures soon, which will begin to give you a little bit of a taste of
it. One quick follow-up, Mr. Please. Chair. Ben, could you also touch on the relationship with the OEIB and the HEC?
Sure.
Is post-secondary well served by having the OEIB in its position over the HEC?
Representative Johnson, Chair Reed, yes. And I think the primary way to understand the role of the OEIB relative to higher education in the state is its focus on that key transition, or transitions, really. But I'll focus on grades 11 to 14. The HEC, formally, is responsible for coordination within the higher education system. So we spend a lot of time on issues of transfer, for example, from community colleges to public universities or vice versa, and thinking about the privates as well. In the absence of OEIB, there would not be an authority. There would not be a chief education officer or a board calling on us and requiring us as a commission as a staff to work closely with K-12 to ensure that very crucial alignment existed. Now, I can assure you that our institutions were working hard on issues of K-12 articulation before there was an OEIB, and they will continue to. But from a state standpoint, I think there has been great value in having an entity with the authority to tell me, tell my staff, and work with our commission on those K-12 alignment issues in particular. And I think that's where I've seen the greatest value.
Thank you.
I've mentioned most pieces of this, but just to a couple more slides on the governance. Nothing changed about the responsibility or, of course, the existence of institutional, locally elected, separately governed boards for our community colleges. We did, of course, create new institutional but state-appointed, there's a distinction there, boards for our public universities, charters at those universities to protect the public missions of them. And on the state side, I mentioned going from four boards to one, clarifying roles, creating a single post-secondary agency or collection of offices, and to Representative Johnson's point, freeing up resources for our institutions. The HEC's responsibilities focused on the issues that you see described here, and then grades 11 through 14 connected through the OEIB. So the dollars, and just a couple of slides on this, what I've depicted here is our 2013-15, our current biennium's budget for higher education in all its parts, and then the governor's recommended budget for 2015-17. Understanding that's not necessarily where this body begins its deliberations, but nevertheless, one way of looking at the 2015-17 budget that you'll be eventually adopting. A couple of things to note here, obviously the bulk of the state's dollars that you appropriate for higher education go to our community colleges and public universities. So that's those two large middle bars. As you look at, as you compare 2013-15 to the 2015-17 GRB, there are a few trends. First of all, an overall increase that is notable and important. That increase showing up largely in a few categories. The first is on the far left-hand side, and it's debt service. This is the cost of servicing bonding that the state of Oregon has done for community colleges and for public universities. A sizable increase in financial aid, and that's the Oregon Opportunity Grant, our state's need-based program, increases to those community college and public university funds. And then that final category there is other, and there are a variety of things in this, including the HEC agency funding. And I just wanted to make sure you knew what was that's what was referred to in that final little slice.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Ben, could you go back a slide? I saw consumer protection mentioned in the slide, and my Rolodex started spinning. The Office of Degree Authorization, which is basically a consumer protection arm of, is that under your purview? And
yes.
Where is that housed now? It's moved, and I'm not quite sure where it is anymore.
Representative McEwen, Chair Reed, yes. So the private degree granting institutions in Oregon interface with the HEC through our Office of Degree Authorization. That is housed physically in the Somerville building, just catty corner of the Capitol here, adjacent to my offices and the rest of the HEC staff. So we have created we've moved the Office of Degree Authorization and the licensing agency office for our private career schools, non-degree granting, into a single, which used to be in the Oregon Department of Education, mm-hmm. into a single office that is.
So those are blended, which makes perfect sense.
Yep.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yep.
Representative Reardon?
Yeah, Ben, is it, I just want to, kind of learning this whole landscape here on the financial part, is it correct to say that the level of state support includes debt service, financial aid, community colleges, and public universities? Because we sometimes talk about the community college budget or the budget for the universities. How does financial aid fit into that? I mean, it seems to be part of the picture.
Representative Reardon, yes, I think it is accurate. And I don't believe that an Oregon legislative committee has seen a slide like this, at least in recent years, because there has not been a HEC that has had responsibility for advising you on the total higher education budget. The commission believes and under statute is responsible for developing a budget that does reflect each of those categories, including financial aid, including debt service, including community colleges and public universities, OHSU, our state programs, et cetera, and think this is the appropriate sort of view of the higher education landscape in total. Historically, you've heard about community college funding. You've heard about separately about public university funding and separately about financial aid. And our responsibility and our value add, if there is some, which I believe there is in the presentation of a single higher education budget that allows the legislature to look at the trade-offs between investments and the overall investment sort of picture story for higher education writ large, including each of these categories.
Make sure I understand the question you asked and the answer. You're asking if the debt service and financial aid applies both to community colleges and public universities?
Well, and that would be another way to ask the question, but I was just trying to see that we are getting representation here of state support, total state support for the system.
Got it.
But you're breaking that down a little bit also, which I think is good.
And Representative Reed, Chair Reed, yes, the debt service and financial aid does apply to both of those sectors. And in fact, financial aid, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, benefits students who attend many of Oregon's private institutions as well. They're also eligible. Many of those students are also eligible for the Oregon Opportunity Grant.
Thanks.
One more, please.
Okay. And then we'll come to Representative Newman.
And why the, without editorializing, why the dramatic increase in debt service?
Representative Reardon, Chair Reed, it's one doesn't have to editorialize it, because it's just, it's simply a matter of fact that the state of Oregon has, in especially over the last decade, significantly increased its capital investment, its bonding, its borrowing for public higher education.
Okay. Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So at the top it says, what is the state investment? Is all of this state money, or is some of it federal money, or student tuition? Or
Representative Nierman, Chair Reed, it's a great question, and I should have said at the outset, this is all state general fund. So it does not include federal funds, including some that come through the state and are deployed to institutions, nor does it include student tuition dollars. So a really important question. This represents only state general fund.
Thank you. And lottery fund, according to
the I'm sorry, and lottery fund. Right. There's a small amount of lottery dollars in there, yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cannon, can you comment on that, the thing at the bottom of the page there? What is that, the new investments in youth employment? Do you want to comment on that?
Representative Wisnett, Chair Reed. Yes, that final note indicates that it's actually not depicted as on this slide, but there are some workforce investments and community innovation or community sort of regional work investments that the governor's budget proposes that are proposed within the HEC budget that I didn't include here because they're new programs that wouldn't represent sort of an apples to apples comparison, but with 2013-15. And they're largely workforce focused. This committee may want to learn more about them. I'm certain that the Ways and Means Subcommittee will, but they're listed at the bottom.
Thank you.
So make sure I'm on the right spot here. When we talk about state funding for higher education, it is easy to get depressed because Oregon's funding for higher education is paltry relative to the national average. I don't think there's any other way to put it. And this slide depicts our appropriations per student, per FTE, compared to the state, compared to the national average. So those states in blue are states, and I'm sorry, I know this, the writing's very small in this, those states in blue are states where they're surpassing the national average in state investments, and those states in yellow are below it. This is from FY 2013. The state is in the midst of being updated, but we're somewhere in that bottom three or four states at a couple of $1,000 per student less than the national average in state investment.
Worth noting, too, here the source, which I probably should have cued you on the last time, WICHE, at the bottom there, a really useful multi-state institution.
And you may wonder how that has changed in Oregon over time. Well, here is our current state funding per FTE, and I've broken it out now for public universities and community colleges. The last slide combined the two. But here you can see it by sector, and then in comparison to where we were in 15 years ago. So actually 15 years ago, and this is not inflation adjusted, it is on a per student basis. So these aren't aggregate sums. They're expressed per student, but not inflation adjusted. And you can see that in 15 years, our funding per student for the public universities has declined by nearly 20%. There's been a slight uptick in community college funding per student, but not nearly at the rate that would be required even to meet general inflation, much less the kind of inflation that or the kind of cost pressures that public sector institutions and higher education generally has experienced. And I know you'll be talking more about that on Wednesday. The couple of words about affordability here. One of the effects of being in a state where we spend relatively less compared to the national average of public dollars on higher education is that students spend relatively more. And so this is net tuition as a percentage of public higher education revenue by state. And you can see that students in Oregon are paying over 60% of the total cost compared to a national average of 47.5%. Again, from WICHE, we are among the higher tuition states in the country, so a low state investment, high tuition state. We're also a low state need-based aid state, at least compared to a couple of nearby counterparts. So our state need-based aid program, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which we administer through the Office of Student Access and Completion, formerly OSAC, formerly the Oregon Student Access Commission, runs at about $305 per student compared to the national average of $509. So your list is as good as mine when it comes to upcoming issues for this legislative session. I suppose these are obvious ones and just very general topics, funding, affordability, and I've called out some of the issues that we're hearing about, as are you. Alignment, both within higher education and with K-12, outcomes-based funding, consumer protection issues, workforce training, and I know that this list, just from looking at bill introductions, could be significantly longer, but these are a few of the topics that we expect you, as well as your counterparts in other states, and we participate in national organizations and read about the work occurring in other states, and this is a very similar list to many states and their legislative sessions this year. I did want, before I turn it over to Jim, I wanted to just say a few words about how we might get to this ambitious aspirational goal on relatively fewer state resources than other places. How can we hold this together in our heads, and what may represent some promising opportunities to move forward? And let me just start by noting our relatively low completion rates. And I don't mean this to be punitive towards students or towards institutions, certainly, because we're having remarkable success in spite of the challenges, including the challenges created by low state funding. But I think it is worth noting that our students,
so we've had 10 years.
And this is outcomes for Oregon's high school graduating class of 2005, and you can see that you know we're not on that 40-40-20 path. What I'd like you to sort of overlay this slide with is the fact that most Oregon students, although very few, as expressed in this chart, the smaller wedges of this pie, are earning a degree. Many of them are enrolling in post-secondary education. So there's this big gap between enrollment, students who are taking some courses somewhere along the way, and completion of a credential or degree. And we would suggest, and our commission has been especially focused on how to improve the success rates, how to improve the completion rates of Oregon students. I'll note, and sorry, there's a little graphical error with this slide. This is a particularly fascinating chart, a lot of data in here that the commission has been especially interested in, that expresses the fact that low-income students and higher-income students who achieved in high school at about the same rate, so this takes their test scores, their high school math test scores, puts the students on deciles, breaks them up, so you're comparing like students with like scores. If they're higher income, they're almost twice as likely to have earned a degree 7-8 years later. There is this immense opportunity with students who have the ability, who have the desire, are not experiencing sufficient opportunity and sufficient support to earn that degree or certificate, and think that does represent a path forward. And you will hear, I think, from Bridget as well as from others over the course of the session, of ways in which our institutions with greater or lesser degrees of state support, usually lesser degrees of state support, are attempting to fill those gaps, are attempting to improve and reinforce student support, improve completion rates.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, Ben, I did have one question maybe you could help me think about. We're talking mainly about outcomes related to graduation and so on. You know, I'm also concerned about the content. I mean, what's happening in the curriculums for our workforce training? And also I'm thinking also that we're really talking about, indicators way early on, and we're talking about third grade and certain levels of achievement even at that level indicate success later on in terms of high school and even college graduation. So how is the heck going to be able to help this committee to sort of understand the relationship then between those graduation outcomes as well as the content outcomes. I mean, what is our workforce really learning? Are they getting what they need out of these programs?
Representative Geigs, Chair Reed, I think it's a great topic, and I hope the HEC can help. I think we and you will rely to a great extent on our institutions as well in providing that information, updating you on the way that they're thinking about content. But to be clear, the state historically and today is not has not been in the business of directing content at our universities and colleges, but I think it's a very important conversation to have. This should not be about certificates and degrees for the sake of certificates and degrees. It's not about pieces of paper, right? It is about the experience, the skills, the knowledge, dispositions of students who are experiencing higher education and what they come away with in those terms. We simplify it by talking about degrees and certificates, but I think it's very important to have that conversation as well about what those pieces of paper actually signify.
Representative McEwen.
At the risk of looking back through time, we've known this for a very long time. These are not new statistics, that the level of math a student achieves in high school is directly correlated to the numbers that you see here. We've known this for 15, 20 years. And it's just an editorial comment that it's discouraging that we're not moving that dial either. And I know that we bumped up our level of math that we're requiring for high school. It took a very long time to get there, but if you compare us to other countries, we're still low, and it's still showing out in these statistics that we have students who maybe not be as well supported in trying to take those harder classes. Mm-hmm. When they do hit them, maybe the tutorial pieces aren't there that are helping them be successful. But this is something that I just find very disturbing, because we've known it's there for a long time.
Agreed.
And it's not an issue that you need to deal with. It's a K-12 issue, but
Representative McEwen, Chair Reed, I think this slide is, you're right, it's not new. It tells at least two stories, one of which is, I think, especially obvious, which is that higher levels of math ability are correlated with higher likelihood of degree completion. Mm-hmm. I suppose that's common sense. I think what really stood out to our commission was the fact that when you controlled for math ability, when you compared students who scored equally well, whether or not they were free and reduced lunch, whether or not they were low income, seemed to make all the difference about their likelihood of earning a degree. And at that lens on this problem was pretty startling to the commission. Startling is probably the wrong word. I think that too was not. They would have predicted that, but to see this played out, and this is longitudinal Oregon-based data, I think was powerful and helped affect and shape their thinking, our commission's thinking about recommendations, particularly related to financial aid and the cost of college.
And we're creating a two-class system here in how we're supporting kids through reaching that higher level of math achievement. And this just bears it out right here that we have a lot of work to do in this department. And I know it's really not a higher ed issue, but it plays out in higher ed because these are the kids that have completion issues. So I just wanted to make a note that this is a serious issue that I hope that the state can step up and have more of an impact on over time.
Great.
Thank you.
Representative Hayden.
Mr. Cannon, you mentioned on your one slide of American 100 American students there, and it talked about in the classroom or online. My question is, do we look and are we developing one for Oregon that also looks at taking the information of trade schools? For example, students, we had 44% of males there. Do we look at or can we add in information on who got a CDL or who got a welding degree or where are the 66% going? Do we have that information? Do we know that? Do we track that? I think you talked about wanting to get a little more information on the non-degree certificates and with our private education entities. How is that going to come together, and are you developing something that can tell us that?
Yeah, Representative Hayden, Chair Reed, I appreciate the attention to that question of data around the non-degree side of our higher education equation. We are weak in that regard in terms of what we know directly from institutions and from students. And I don't have the, I'm not prepared with the sort of specific example or expression of where we are in improving our understanding of certificates and licenses that are awarded by trade schools, et cetera. I know we're working on it, and I will bring back to this committee in writing or however you choose an update on that process and what we know, what we don't, and what the plans are to understand it better. Because you're right that if I understand the implication of these questions, this Higher Education Commission, and I believe this committee, are not singularly focused on degree granting institutions, right? 40-40-20 is about a lot more than degrees, and I agree it's a weak link in our understanding today.
Thanks.
Final slides here. I did, so why does it matter? And I wanted to end on perhaps a somewhat more upbeat note, and I don't think this commission or this committee takes any convincing on this in this respect, but just the impact of higher education on one's outcomes in life. And this takes a single lens of earnings and employment and expresses what, again, we sort of know intuitively to be true, which is that higher levels of educational attainment are correlated with lower rates of unemployment and higher earnings. I have to note, of course, that higher education is about a lot more than earnings and workforce outcomes, but it is obviously an important way for the state to understand the investment that it's making, particularly when these earnings are reflected in the form of revenues for the state. This is a high ROI activity, and while you're not a budget committee, it felt worthwhile to make that point, not maybe so much for what it means for the state, but what it means for the individuals whom we touch in our higher education system. And that's the conclusion of my presentation. I think Jim was going to speak a little to the community college's perspective on this work.
Terrific. Thank you, Ben. And we've also been joined since you started by Bridget Burns. Bridget, you can join us up here or sit there until Jim's finished. We appreciate you being here as well. Jim, it's your turn. We're all assembled and eager to hear from you. You may be on mute. Are you still there, Jim?
Yes, I am.
There we are.
Hey, guys. It's politely on mute.
Thank you.
Chair, Vice Chair Gallegos, and RISNET committee. For the record, I'm Jim Middleton, the interim commissioner for community college, and recently retired as president of Central Oregon Community College. I'll try to pause strategically here so that if there are questions, I can hear the phone kick over to your side as we go along.
Thank you.
Really, four elements that I want to try to cover quickly. I think two sides of what I see as an opportunity and challenge, not just for community colleges, but higher ed in general. Secondly, the community college's role in the 40-40-20 spectrum. Third, some key initiatives. And fourth, some needs for supporting those initiatives. So our first, as we look at the challenge, I see it in we're torn. We've got two elements that we have to pay attention to. The first that Ben is focused on is we do need to improve our effectiveness with the educational pipeline. Those are the students who a couple years ago started in kindergarten that we focus on being the graduates of 2025. We need to move from the approximately 67% high school graduation to our aspiration of 100% high school graduation. And once we get them graduated, we need to get a higher percentage entering both our 2- and 4-year programs. And once they're there, we need to get better completion. We need to keep them in our colleges, both 2- and 4-year, address the remediation, shorten the time to the degree, ensure geographic access, financial access, and get them to the finish line. So the pipeline needs a lot of work. But even if we magically waved our wand and met 40-40-20 for the pipeline, we still have an equal, if not bigger, challenge. I asked the Oregon Employment Department for this data, and interestingly, if we look at today's workforce, 82% of today's workforce will still be in the workforce in 2025. So what that means is if we were perfect with the pipeline, we would still be touching only 18% of the workforce. So we've got a lot of people right now who didn't finish high school, who didn't get degrees, and we still have, unfortunately, more of those being added to the ranks of the undereducated. And so the community colleges play a very significant role in bringing individuals back into the educational arena and embracing that 82%. Community colleges really sit at a critical role across all three of the elements of 40-40-20. Increasingly, the community colleges are playing a role in assisting with high school completion, collaboration with the high schools, working to help the high schools generate college credit for their students while they're still in high school. But beyond the pipeline, doing work with GED preparation, English language learning, adult basic skills, and even providing the adult high school degree through the community colleges. So there's this, interestingly, Portland Community College, it awards more high school degrees than any school district in the state. The middle 40 is clearly our home, but it also, as Ben indicated, shows the largest gap in achievement, where we're not meeting that 40%. The focus on the two-year degree, the two-year, one-year certificate, and increasingly attention to shorter-term certificates where students, particularly in career areas, are doing shorter-term focused areas that can result in some formal certification. Unfortunately, a significant portion of the work is being done with remedial and developmental, both for students who enter directly from high school, but also those who are returning. Career training, and then also significant support in partnership, not just training people for careers, but working with businesses through our small business development centers and other elements. Lastly, then, the baccalaureate 40, through our transfer associate degrees, and transfer, many students transfer before they finish their two-year associate degree. Very interestingly, one in every five Oregonian university students is a transfer from the Oregon Community College. So a full 20% of the students, their pathway to the baccalaureate is through the community college. And I think increasingly what we're seeing in that realm are partnerships with a number of the community colleges with either the big three statewide institutions or the local regional institution to address a number of issues. Some of the initiatives that have been underway, and I really like to talk about that at three different levels. First, the sort of pre-collegiate, increasing work statewide on attention to dual enrollment, and that is getting students who are still in high school the opportunity to have high school credit. OEIB has set the target of three courses for all, trying to make those accessible for all Oregonian students. There's a commitment to expansion of that, but also a commitment to make sure that, that those courses that we deliver meet the rigor of collegiate work, and that we see greater congruence between the college courses and standards and what is being delivered in the high schools. So beyond the pre-collegiate, mentioned before the importance of once we get students through the door to get them oriented appropriately for success. Increased attention to mandatory testing and orientation, student success courses, improved advising, financial aid. And one of the aspects that there's been some discussion about in particular is work on redesign of some of the remedial education, specifically in mathematics, to look at a mathematics that is more effective for students over the long run. And then also trying to do a better job of connecting the students who do adult basic skills and English language learning to move them on to the regular collegiate community college courses. Unfortunately, nationally and statewide, our record hasn't been good on moving those students who do adult basic skills on into, you know, the collegiate world. And then getting students to progress and get to the finish line. There's been significant expansion at Oregon Community Colleges in establishing learning communities that bring groups of students together that bridge multiple courses that they become a cohort. Sort of first term, first year experiences that have more wraparound students, wraparound services to the students, learning tutoring centers, peer mentoring, early warning systems that give signs of when students may be dropping back, streamlining the degrees and doing more professional development with our staff. And then really trying to create that sense of commitment to completion, better data tracking, and better degree auditing, you know, systems. Community colleges have recently worked much harder to improve our data systems so that we can both ask and answer better questions. So we've established a D4A system, which is really data for analysis. And is a major step toward getting a statewide longitudinal database system established so that we can track students throughout their educational work. That system helps to integrate the adult basic skills, GED, community college unified records, some of the Youth Conservation Corps, course approval, financial aid, trying to get all of that into one large database. Ben had indicated that both at the 2 and 4 year level, we are bringing forward proposals for outcomes-based funding. Traditionally, across the nation, we funded only enrollment. Now, 35 states have systems that in whole or in part link the state funding to what the 2 or 4 year institutions are able to achieve as outcomes. And we're in the process of putting those systems in place. Back to the developmental education, Oregon mirrors the nation, where about 60 to 70% of the students enter the community college deficient in math, writing, or reading. This is not just a challenge of giving them a little bit more work, but as Bennett indicated, we have challenges with lower income students. The students who move into remediation, frankly, have poor completion results. Of those that are put into English, are deficient in writing, in 2 years, only 41% of them ever finish a college-level writing class. In math, if they put in remedial math, in 2 years, only 26% have completed college math. And if they're deficient in both, only 16% of them make it through that gateway math and writing course. Part of the work that has been done nationally and that a very good work is being done in Oregon is working on redesigning some of the math. And it really isn't a compromising of the standards, but for decades and centuries, we've really pretended that pre-calculus is the only math that really counts. And Representative Gallegos, you were talking about the connection between you know, the curriculum and what the workforce needs, we see a much greater need for statistical awareness in many careers and basic quantitative reasoning skills rather than pre-calculus algebra. And so that we're working to establish alternative routes that appropriately fit the career programs better, and then we'll have to work with the universities to ensure that those courses also then align with the university requirements as the students transfer. Then moving toward some closure here, I think as we see the greater challenges and frankly the greater commitment, much of the work that needs to be done is not just in the classroom, but it really is a lot of the wraparound services that are there before enrollment, during enrollment, and supporting students getting to that finish line. So certainly the key is our great faculty in the classroom, but they can't do it alone. They need a lot of the other support. As Ben pointed out, you know, the funding for community colleges is now on a dollar basis about where we were 15 years ago on a per student basis. It's sad at one level to celebrate that we finally got back to that level because we did dip significantly below that. And a number of institutions, frankly, in a good Midwest metaphor, had to eat their seed corn to get through the past several years. And so it's not just getting back to that starting point, but really trying to recover from some of the other investment compromises over the past several years as we locally and nationally face some challenges. So that's a quick overview of what I see of how, you know, community colleges link in with the general priorities that Ben had summarized, and open for any specific questions.
Thank you very much, Jim. I'm looking up and down to see if there are any questions, and it looks like you've done such a good job that we are mostly silent for the moment. I appreciate it, and I imagine we will have more opportunities to absorb your wisdom as we go forward. With that, I'm very glad that Bridget Burns is with us. She, as many of you know, is a veteran of the Chancellor's Office in Oregon, but now has a very different and very exciting role. We've heard sort of the Oregon perspective, and now we get to hear a little bit more of a national perspective. I won't attempt to describe the alliance, but I'm excited that you're here to do it. We appreciate you being here, and the floor is yours.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bridget Burns, and I'm the Executive Director of the University Innovation Alliance, which is a national consortium of large public research universities committed to sharing best practices and scaling up proven interventions to improve outcomes for low-income students. We have a video that I believe will do an even better job of summarizing what we're doing, and so I think we'll show that.
Great.
America's success in an increasingly competitive world economy depends upon our ability to solve two major problems. First, our educational system is not producing the results our country needs. The United States economy faces a shortage of 16 million college graduates by the year 2025.
For the something first muted time somewhere. In US history,
yeah, younger adults are less well educated than their parents. We know talent and drive are well distributed.
I see a little red thing down in the corner.
Not at full volume.
We're just trying to make sure we're paying very close attention and listening very carefully.
Sorry, that's full volume.
Across our population.
Can you put a mic on?
High-income students are 7 times more likely to get a college degree than our low-income students. Our universities have to do better at nurturing that talent because we cannot meet our educational goals until we find ways for all students to succeed. The second problem is that universities exist in a competitive environment. This can work against us by keeping valuable ideas and strategies from spreading. We have hotspots of innovative student success initiatives around the country. Too often, these good ideas are staying where they're born. There are nearly 700 public universities in the U.S., enrolling almost 7 million undergraduate students. We need to spread proven innovations and scale them up from place to place. Only then can we graduate a higher number of students, including low-income students, with quality degrees. Solving these two major problems was the motivation for our 11 large public research universities to come together to form the University Innovation Alliance. We'll share practical and cost-efficient solutions proven to help students succeed and spread them across our institutions and the nation. We're going to work together to help thousands more students each year achieve a college degree. If we can do this, we can create a brighter future for students from all economic backgrounds, and we can regain America's global competitiveness for generations to come.
So if you heard the whisper from that, then you picked it up. So otherwise, for those of you who couldn't hear, this is available on YouTube. But what we are is committed to closing the achievement gap, specifically the delta between the achievement of low-income students and high-income students. As we stand right now, we are facing at least a shortage of 16 million college graduates by the year 2025. And one of the challenges facing our country is that today there are more people walking around the United States who went to college and did not get a degree than those who went to college and have a degree. So it's not the problem of enrolling them. It's actually a problem of serving them and applying interventions when they are off track, getting them on track, helping them to graduate in time. Now, we talked a lot about financial access and affordability, and I know that will be a topic coming before you quite a bit this year. That is one of the tools, but there are actually a variety of tools that need to be deployed to help students, especially when they're struggling. So I'll just give you a little bit of a sense of what we're about to do. There is a PowerPoint that, if you can move to slide number two. Maybe I should transition with you. So what was brought up in the video is that one of the fundamental challenges facing the country is that institutions are set up in a competitive environment, which means that ideas do not spread from place to place. And I spent the last year interviewing university leaders around the country, and I asked them, you know, what are you doing that's innovative to serve students? And most of the time I found that universities fell into one of three categories. I would ask someone to show me something innovative, and they would show me something that's not innovative, something like performance-based funding or something that you could see 50 miles down the road or done better somewhere else. And most of the time, typically not very aware of the other places that those ideas have already been used. There's a group over here where they were innovative in ways that they didn't even realize, because that's just how they do what they do. And there are probably less than 30 universities in the country engaging in active experimentation to test what works and what doesn't, and trying to scale up interventions that they can empirically show make a big difference, and are working to share those interventions. So I work with 11 institutions, of which some of them are in that group. But what I would tell you about the University Innovation Alliance is, one, none of my institutions are in the same state, so they do not compete for students or resources. And that's a critical path to achieving collaboration, because it is an elbows-out race for rankings and for resources. And ultimately, we find that it's very challenging to collaborate between institutions. And then also I would tell you that most of our institutions are all doing something interesting, but none of them are doing the same thing. So what you'll see is a perfect constellation of mentees and mentors. You can get the second one. And those are the institutions that I'm working with. So the reason why I'm here to talk to you about this today is one of those institutions is here in Oregon, Oregon State University, and they are working as a partner in the Alliance, trying to figure out if we can determine, one, what are the best ways to help students who are off track, specifically low-income, first-generation, and students of color? What works? What doesn't? What can we learn from what doesn't work, and how can we share that? And two, is there a method that we can extract from this process for scale? We find that the biggest challenge facing higher ed, there are a number of them, but I would argue that the most significant one is a diffusion problem. It's not that we don't have enough ideas. There are actually a zillion pilots out there. We know
how to help students who are off track. It's not something we need to reinvent the wheel on. The problem is sharing ideas from place to place. Now, in a competitive environment, it's almost like interventions to serve students are a trade secret. And we fundamentally disagree with that. We believe that we should do a better job finding a common space to share these ideas. So if you can move the next one. So the core purpose behind the Alliance is that we believe every child deserves the opportunity to be educated. We think universities need strategies and tools to serve more low-income students, and ultimately we think that the best path forward is through collaboration. In my past life, working in the university system, I was frustrated for a long time trying to figure out why is it so hard to get universities to want to collaborate? You know, when they would start this program that some other institution in the same state has or would compete in the legislature on capital construction initiatives that seemed like it didn't actually help students. And I didn't understand why was it so hard to want to collaborate, and what were the issues that we needed to unpack around that? And so I went and spent the year at Arizona State University and did a lot of these interviews, and what I found was collaboration is actually an uncomfortable and often painful experience. It's not necessarily a positive one for institutions, that often when you work with another institution, you have to figure out their bureaucracy, their infrastructure, the way that their leadership style is different. Often there are arguments about whose logo goes first, and it's not because everyone doesn't have the best of intentions. It's actually because the organizational design of higher education has pitted universities against each other for such a long time that it actually makes it fundamentally challenging for us to figure out how to work together. So the premise of the Alliance is I get up every day trying to find a way to make collaboration positive for each of these institutions, and we're trying to find a different way to share ideas between them. Because what we find is we all care about the same stuff, we all care about serving students, and most of us could benefit from putting 11 heads together instead of just one. We think that the idea that any one of us has a silver bullet solution is just not realistic. Further, as these institutions have got to know each other better, we have found that there are significant lessons to be learned. The work that we're engaging in, innovation, scale, and diffusion, I can give you an example of why these institutions would be focusing on that. Two of my institutions, one, University of California, Riverside, has eliminated income and race as a predictor of outcome. They're the only university in the country that I can say that about. Georgia State University has eliminated race as a predictor of outcome. If you're looking for a policy priority, I would say focusing on shrinking the delta in performance between low-income students and high-income students is the kind of work this country needs to have done. And again, like I said earlier, there's a lot of students we admit and they just don't complete. And that's the issue we need to focus on. And it's not because we don't have institutions that are working on this issue. It's actually that it's a very complicated issue. And there are a variety of interventions depending on the type of student. You can go back one. Sorry. The first concept is innovation. Again, 11 heads are better than one, and we're going to work on some of the shared challenges. Two, scale, and this is the most important. So we've been funded $5.7 million by six major foundations, including the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is particularly committed to scale because, again, we have enough pilots and one-offs and single-source solutions. What we really need to focus on is spreading ideas from place to place. The challenge facing higher ed is that the way that we share ideas is usually twofold. You go to a conference and you hear a good idea on stage, and then you go home and you tinker in the dark, unaware there are other people duplicating the same experiment in a silo somewhere around the country. And there's not a way for us to connect those people who are engaging in similar kinds of work to share with each other, hey, I tried this, it didn't work, heads up, don't do this, or here's what I learned. And we think that's what really matters. The magic is actually around the change management lessons and best practices. It's not a magic bullet technology solution. Because for every technology solution I can talk to you about, I can show you a campus where it has been a total dud on. Because they lack the capacity to really focus on the change management issues, how to bring people on board, and the types of leadership that you can that you need. So scale is taking an idea from one place to another place. This is the problem. We know that conferences don't work. People don't really read white papers, which is tragic for those of us who have written a lot of white papers. But the truth is that these jobs are too hard. I followed university presidents around for a year, and I cannot tell you enough how hard those jobs are and the impossibility of actually drilling down on every issue. It's just not possible. And most people who work in these universities are doing multiple jobs. The administrative bloat narrative is just not true, not where I've been seeing on campuses around the country, and certainly not here in Oregon, the ones that I've worked with. So,
one quick question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Representative Wizard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Burns, why did you not include or look at including in this alliance one or two private schools?
These are large. Chair Reed, co-chair Wisnant, vice chair Wisnant. These are the one thing that's critical for collaboration is something that you have in common. So the fact that these are all large, public, research-intensive universities, they're struggling with the same kinds of challenges in separate states. They all have to work on issues with their policymakers. They're all struggling with per capita funding going down. They're all struggling with working, in many cases, as a quasi-state public agency. And I think that having something in common will actually help us be able to link elbows and march toward a common goal rather than the elbows-out competition. So, and we don't believe that this is the only one that should exist. We hope more alliances form. But I frankly cannot fly to more than 11 universities on a regular basis. So as the only staff for this, it's part physical preservation. But also, we actually want this to be meaningful. We don't. The types of collaboration you can see around the country are forced, ones of convenience, and ones in name only. There are some collaborative ventures. There's the Committee for Interinstitutional Cooperation. It's been around for 50 years. It's primarily the Big Ten schools that have really found a way to work together. But it's, again, based on common things, what they have in common, figuring out how to share services across state, do collaborative research agendas, things like that. So my answer is I think that for the scale that we need to focus on, every one of my institutions is serving more than 20,000 students. And while there is a place for every type of university, there are 4,634 colleges and universities in this country, and there are all kinds of types of them. But there are nearly 700 public research universities. And we think that this is the place where we really need to find some solutions to actually impact that million student deficit in the future. So scale is the most important thing. Transferring ideas across the country, across types of institutions, figuring out how to adapt. And finally, diffusion. We want to figure out how we can share the lessons learned to help other students so that they're not having to make the same mistakes that other campuses have made. Ultimately, we think that there's a lot to be learned from each other from failure. So what I can share with you just some of the lessons learned from the first year. One thing that we've done recently, and the White House announced this at their College Access Summit, we have committed that the 11 institutions combined are going to graduate an additional 68,000 students over the next 10 years, and at least half of them are going to be low income. So in terms of why large public research universities, we believe that it's because we think that kind of scale change can be achieved. So what I can recommend for you as you move forward and engage in work around university innovation, I don't have a lot of time today, and I'm not in Oregon often, so I wanted to take advantage of the opportunity to share what I can with you. I would tell you that some of the things we've learned is that student success is a financial sustainability strategy. At Georgia State University, what I've seen there has been masterful. It was a kind of a middle institution that was really struggling about a decade ago. And about 7 years ago, the new president, Mark Becker, went to the legislature and the state board in Georgia and asked for something that was very unusual. He asked for 40 advisors. Most of the time when presidents come to ask for funding, it's not for something so specific. But they knew that they were struggling, especially with low-income and African-American students. And so over the past 7 years, what they've done is through bringing in intense predictive analytics, but supported by advisors who are applying on-demand interventions to students, they have improved their graduation rate by 22 points. And what was interesting to me in that example is it cost about $1.8 million to get those advisors. And by doing that, they have improved their retention rates so much that every year, for every single percentage point they've improved, that's $3 million in additional revenue they're bringing in from students. So for them, while it was 1.8 up front, the reality is that long term, the financial sustainability of the institution depends on our ability to do a better job serving students, retaining them, and graduating them. They've also saved a lot of money for students by improving the throughput of students and decreasing their time to degree by half a semester. They've saved their students $10 million in tuition. So if you think about student success, often we think of it as something that you know we want to do. If we could, we'd do it really well. But there's a million other things pulling at our plate, and funding is one of them. I think you should see that student success and interventions to help students get back on track and graduate are absolutely essential to the long-term financial health of your institutions. I would say that the core focus, number two, the core focus of work should be thinking about how are you serving low-income students right now? What is your four-year graduation rate for low-income students versus high-income students, students of color, first generation? And the real hard work is shrinking that delta. And you can shrink that delta by cherry-picking and only including high-income students and just basically focusing on exclusivity. So I would urge you to think, when you're making policy, to think about the exclusivity consequences. So there's a way, if you do performance funding where you only fund degrees, where you could just admit the high achieving students. And I would say that's probably not in the best interest of the long-term economic success of your state. I would also say that finding ways to make collaboration a positive experience and encouraging it and incentivizing it is something that states should be working on. It's something that, again, it really wasn't a focus for a long time because we had systems, and even when we had a university system that was fully fledged, the type of collaboration we're talking about is just fundamentally different. It is opening the vest, sharing what's happening on your campus so that you really can help other people move ahead. Because we believe that when universities work together and collaborate, that students are the ones who win. So, my goal today was to try and share with you a little sense of the work of the Alliance. And what we're doing. And so the reason why this matters for you all is Oregon State is going to be engaging in a variety of innovative work in partnership with these campuses. And I know that President Ray has talked about sharing those ideas more broadly with Oregon institutions. And I think that his leadership is already evident with bringing together the President's Collaborative 2.0, the meeting they recently held where public and private institutions were brought together. And I think, you know, that's one of the more positive things I've seen in any of the states I'm working on is institutions just deciding that working together is in the best interest of everybody. So I'm happy to answer any questions you might have or provide any assistance if you might need in the future pertaining to some of these student success innovations.
Thank you very much. And before we go to questions, I have to thank the HEC executive director. I didn't know that the assistance with slides was amongst your duties. It was well done. Representative Gallegos.
Thank you. So where's the headquarters? Where are you headquartered at?
You're looking at them.
All right. Well, good.
So I have an office in Arizona, at Arizona State University, but also in Portland at the Oregon State University Foundation.
Oh, good. Welcome home. It's good to have you back. It's
wherever she is.
And
how many frequent flyer miles have you racked up?
Well, I doubled down on Southwest, so everyone's first class on Southwest, so nice. It was a really strategic move.
Smart.
So I didn't have, like, two or three questions separate. One was, I mean, I know you're probably familiar with Future Connect here in Oregon with PCC, and the whole focus of that is to provide scholarships for first-generation, low-income students. And that has like a 97% graduation rate. I mean, it's awesome. So we hope we can continue that kind of program. The other thing I wanted to mention was I've always had trouble with best practice models. I mean, but the problem is really the diffusion. I mean, you know, taking a best practice model from the East Coast and then bringing it here and then making it fit here is really challenging. But I like I said, I think that's you're addressing that with your diffusion model. But and then finally, who are we going to hear from OSU? I'd really be interested in their program.
Chair Reed, Representative Gallegos. So the person I'm working with the most is I think it's Associate Provost Becky Warner, as well as President Ray. And so they have yet to really launch their first big experiment, but they're in the process of adopting. So what I told you about at Georgia State, one of the reasons they've been so successful is they got education advisory board software and they have predictive analytics on board. So they get real-time feedback every Monday. They get a printout of every student who's off track. And they immediately deploy 3,000 advising hours to pull those students in and get them back on track. So if you think about what really makes a difference, it's that. And I would say it's the advisors, but you can't be flying blind. You have to have good data. So Oregon State just signed on with EAB, and they are now uploading years of data to create the analytic structure. And so by the fall, I believe they're planning on being able to launch that with at least two different cohorts or classes. I think programs actually is what they're focusing on. So I would say stay tuned, but the context there would be those folks.
One follow-up comment. Just simply that I won't name the institution, but my last institution, I mean, God, I remember the comment was that, Joe, you know, we've been doing this for 100 years. Why should we change? I mean, that's the institutional change we probably got to face.
Thank you. Representative Nierman, then Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is probably a bigger bite than we have time for right now, but just anecdotally, what are some of the reasons why kids don't graduate that the advisors are working with? And then I'll do a pre-follow-up question is, are there different reasons between the lower-income students and the upper-income students?
Are there continuing? Sorry, to clarify that last part.
Are there different reasons? Do you find there's different reasons between the upper income and the lower income students for not finishing or not graduating?
Chair Reed, Representative Nierman, yes, there are significant differences in terms of the types of challenges students experience based on income. But I would say that there are some shared ones, which is, you know, not having an advisor help walk you through the program of study, changing majors, transferring in, the confusion associated with, you know, coming into a new institution. I would say that advising for me is fine. I'm surprised by how much I'm spending time on advising, because I think it is actually the solution to this problem. Mm-hmm. They are the concierge for the institution, and yet I find that many universities, the higher up in the administration, they don't talk to advisors because there's just so much else going on, and there's so many other inputs and things to worry about, class size and such. So I think seeing advisors as the people on the ground who can report back and flag when there's a bottleneck or there's an issue is important. I would say that there, you know, beyond financial, there's, you know, getting into the right classes, being able to have course offerings. There are types of ways of learning, right? So we're going to be working on adaptive learning because we're finding that there's a lot of success that universities around the country are seeing where they use a hybrid between online and in-person, where they make it so it's there's all kinds of research around best practices with, you know, project-based learning, learning communities. There are interventions that you can use where students are in their housing facility. Michigan State, one of our campuses, has something called the neighborhoods concept. So, you know, your faculty advisors actually are in your housing experience. So they really are creating a nurturing environment. There are a number of factors that impact students, and what we're trying to work on is getting our campuses. Our first big project is predictive analytics, and going to Atlanta next week, where we're bringing 80 people from all these campuses together to work on it. And what we want to do is get everyone's data so it's useful and you can get real-time feedback. And then we want to start accumulating what interventions people use, what doesn't work, for what types of students. Because everyone's had a 36-year-old single mother who's got only 68 credits and needs to have 72. But the types of interventions that people have tried depends on where they're at. And what we need to do is benefit from the experience of other campuses to try and figure out how can we help her as much as possible and quickly and inexpensively. And so we want to create kind of this national lab of the interventions to help students who are off track get back on track. So I would say, yes, it depends on income, but there are some shared characteristics that every campus struggles with.
Good, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bridget, how is the student voice being brought into all of this when you bring those 80 people together? What's the interaction with actual real-life students in your work?
Chair Reed, Representative Williamson, I try to meet with students when I'm on each of the campuses, so a lot of this work is happening by me going around and interviewing people. So I just this last week spent, you know, a couple hour or so with advisors at Oregon State. So try to do that, but I also, in general, I think because my background is in student advocacy and viewing things through the lens of how this is going to impact students, I think we've benefited potentially from that in the past, but we do need to probably come up with a solution in the future that would integrate those recommendations more thoroughly.
Thanks. No one else has questions. I've got one. Well, Representative Johnson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, Bridget, this idea of adding additional academic counselors, facilitators, you know, certainly not rocket science. We've kicked this around for a long time. Remember, PSU did some good work, I think, probably about 4 years ago, mm-hmm. where they increased their ratio and saw some pretty good outcomes and stuff. But most typically, when I get a president in my office, they're apt to be asking for, advocating for that new cap construction project or something that's a you know, shiny object for their institution. So is there any linkage nationally where legislators are linking fully funding, linking funding baselines, whatever, if we give you this, you shall provide this for students related to some sort of ratio that's proven to, you know, work or to certainly move outcomes for students and regarding completion?
Chair Reed, Representative Johnson, I'll wade into this delicately and just say that I think I want to get back to you on this in terms of actually providing you some data, because the truth is, in every one of these subjects, there are a wealth of folks who are doing intensive research. There's mm-hmm. a whole higher education research space. So I would say it's very likely that someone's already done a policy study where they can identify that. My experience is that the thing that institutions need the most is for policymakers to get out of the way of innovation, and that means cutting restrictive barriers or ties or rules that can prevent. Mm-hmm. So seeking those out, rooting them out, and trying to find ways to make it so it's easier for campuses to A, work together, and B, innovate to respond to emerging market needs. But then number two is obviously funding, right? And so what you're talking about is kind of a, can you use funding as an incentive to see this kind of change? You know, I don't think there's a silver bullet for anything. After kicking the tires thoroughly on most of these campuses, what I found is it's a combination of a lot of things. So at Georgia State, the president there begins every single meeting with an update for the entire team talking about data. Where are we now? What did we learn last week from or last month from our recent data? Where are we going? Leadership's willingness to repeat themselves and not assume that ideas just trickle down through the organization, it's very powerful, not something you can pay for, right? The choice to, if he was going to bet, go to double down on anything, to double down on advisors, unusual. To combine that with investing in intense data and analytics and hiring the right team to support them, it's all about how you brought the advisors on board and made it so they weren't threatened by having a data system that they were going to be evaluated based on too, right? So I would say it's a lot of different stuff. And what we're trying to do is, we don't think it's a tool or a kit. We think collaboration is the innovation, right? Figuring out how to actually help these institutions coach each other. But policymakers, that's the one thing I see mostly is complaints about constraints. You all have done a lot of work in this space. I mean, freeing them up from state agency status is a lot, right? And so I'm happy to look for some additional reports to support that.
Thank you.
Can I add to that request? I was really struck by your comment early on about the importance of making it easier and more attractive to collaborate and what barriers. It sounds like you're starting to answer that question a little bit, but as you encounter good examples, I would be interested in that too. And when you do, I think I'm speaking for the whole community, and please share it with the whole committee. I wish we had lots more time. I was really impressed with the questions you all asked. I think it's a great way for us to start. Unfortunately, we're near the end of the time. So thank you both for being here, particularly you, Bridget, because I know you are nearly everywhere else and rarely here. I'm glad it worked out that you could be a part of our kickoff. For the benefit of the committee, a little preview. We've decided for these first few weeks we're going to have kind of on Mondays the broad overview. Wednesday we're going to drill down a little bit more into some specific questions, and Friday we'll have some relevant bills. Week one, obviously, we're going to do higher ed. Week two, we'll do some innovation. Week three, workforce development, and then try to connect them all. So on Wednesday, we'll see Mr. Cannon again, along with some representatives of specific institutions. We'll talk about cost drivers and access and take it from there. So I'm going to close the informational hearing for today and ask if there's anything else to come before the committee today.
Thank you.
We're adjourned. We'll see you Wednesday bright and early. Thanks, everybody.
All right, off we go.
Wednesday bright and early. Thanks, everybody.
All right, off we go.
We're adjourned. We'll see you.